It's very nice to see you all back here tonight and some new faces, folks that weren't able to join us last night. This is the second in this year's series of Rosenbach lectures. For those of you who weren't able to be with us last night, my name is Carton Rogers, and I'm the Director of Libraries here at Penn. It's both a great honor and pleasure to have the Penn Library's name associated with such a longstanding and prestigious lecture series. I'm not going to bore you with going back through my introductory remarks about the genesis and history of the Rosenbach Lecture from last night, but I would again like to recognize my colleagues in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Lynn Farrington, Andrea Gottschalk, Amy Hutchins, David McKnight, John Pollock, Nancy Shawcross, and Dan Traster, who have all been really instrumental in making this year's lectures possible. Yeah. Since I won't be standing up here again on Thursday night, somebody else is doing that honor for me. I have to be somewhere else in the library introducing another event, a video mashup, which is an interesting contrast to what's going on this floor Thursday night. I just want to say that we are blessed here by having a really, really terrific staff in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. They are long-suffering. They work under difficult physical conditions up here, but they do a terrific job, and they are the most service-oriented group of Rare Book and Manuscript Librarians, I think, that exist any place in North America, and we are very, very fortunate to have them as part of the Penn Library's staff. So I do appreciate all that they do for us on a daily basis. I'm reminded that we would like you to sign the guest register at the back. I see Kristen Winch nodding, so please do that before you leave tonight. Also, Nancy and Amy have put together an interesting display of some of our Bibles. That display is in the back of the room, and I hope you'll also take a look at those before you leave. In the spirit of full disclosure, which is in such short supply these days, I do think that I misled you a little bit last night. I correctly listed the three lecture days, but I think I may have mistakenly indicated that there was a reception after each of the lectures. Unfortunately, particularly for those of you who came tonight specifically for the food, there is no free lunch after this particular lecture. And I should know this, the tradition has always been that there would be a lecture following the opening, a reception. Yes, you can see what the priorities are. That there would be a reception after the opening lecture and one again after the closing lecture, but not one in the middle. So again, I apologize if I misled any of you. But the message is come back on Thursday and there'll be another reception. So we hope to see you then for sure. It's my pleasure now to introduce my colleague, Nancy Shawcross, who will introduce our speaker. Nancy is manuscript curator for Penn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Her first professional appointment related to archival collections was at the Dance Collection of the New York Public Library. At Penn, her undergraduate degree in English literature and drama and her master's and doctorate in comparative literature have formed the basis for curating a diverse collection of materials ranging from medieval and Renaissance codex manuscripts to the literary papers of American authors such as Theodore Dreiser, Ezra Pound, and Harry Matthews. Parenthetically, Nancy has recently taken the lead in an extraordinary medieval manuscript initiative that we've undertaken here. She's been working very closely with faculty, many of whom are in the room, and with a very generous collector and benefactor, Larry Schoenberg, with efforts of everybody involved and some financial help from Larry, we've been able to significantly increase our holdings of medieval manuscripts, And we certainly hope that that particular initiative can go on for the indefinite or for the foreseeable future, because it really has made a huge difference. In addition, Nancy oversees the development of our literary arts manuscript collections, of which we have many, and she's also an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of English here at Penn. So please join me in welcoming Nancy Shawcross.
Thank you, Carton. I appreciate the opportunity tonight to introduce Paul Sanger so that I might pay tribute to his innovative work in collection development at the Newberry Library. Paul's gifts and productivity as a scholar are equally apparent with regard to his career as a librarian. As Penn works to resurrect and retool its acquisitions program for medieval and Renaissance manuscripts, Paul's strategies at the Newberry inspire us and challenge the status quo. I want to mention briefly two recent initiatives. The first concerns shared ownership and circulation of manuscripts and some other materials. In general, the Newberry pays for 2/3 of the cost of the new acquisition and serves as the host institution for the item. The collaborating library pays 1/3 of the cost and is allowed to borrow the manuscript for up to 2 months at a time. Beginning with an agreement between the Newberry and the University of Notre Dame, the program now comprises 6 Midwestern institutions of higher education and boasts more than 15 new acquisitions. It's probably more than 15, but that's what I found. A second intriguing development has been Paul's research of and attention to small religious colleges and seminaries that either are closing their doors or are no longer capable of maintaining their rare materials. The transfer of the libraries of these small or now defunct institutions has brought to light some significant manuscripts and incunables made readily available to scholars through the Newberry. Paul represents the best of the two worlds of scholarship and librarianship. He freely shares his expertise and contributes to the struggle we all face in determining just what we are looking at and what did it represent to those who produced it and to those who read it. Paul arrived at the Rare Book and Manuscript Library yesterday morning. By mid-afternoon, he had concluded that a recent acquisition on display in the back and something that will be used in the seminar tomorrow, which I just want to remind you of, that at 10 o'clock in the Lee Library, Paul will conduct a seminar for anyone who wishes to attend. By mid-afternoon, though, he had determined that this Bible was not a Paris Bible as described, that in point of fact, it was most likely copied in England and seems to have led an itinerant life on the continent. I contacted Paul's longtime friend and colleague, the dealer who sold me the manuscript. Her response summarizes the respect and significance given a Paul Sanger assessment. I quote, "His work on the origins of these Bibles is really groundbreaking. I have followed it in previous incarnations. England is better and more expensive usually than France because it's rarer, so bravo to you," meaning to me. And she concluded by saying, "If Paul says so, you can be sure it's right." I want to just throw in another remark. We thought we were beginning this seminar tomorrow with at least 3 Paris Bibles, but Paul just told me that we may have none. Or we may have one that we didn't think was a Paris Bible. So it may rise to the top of our wish list, our desideratum for our next purchase. Maybe we need to find a true Paris Bible. Paul's first lecture confirmed what I, working in my role as a manuscripts acquisition librarian, was told by Henry Charles Lee Professor of Medieval History, Ed Peters. You can never have too many Bibles. Please welcome to the podium again, Paul Sanger, speaking tonight on the birth of modern chapters.
Thank you very much, Nancy, for that. That's very moving introduction. Scholarship is always appreciated. Work in acquisitions often is not, and I was very moved by that. Very generous of you. Let's see. I get my pointer out. The usual account of the origin of the modern chapter division of the Bibles is that they were the invention beginning in about the year 1200 of Stephen Langton, professor of theology at the University of Paris, from 1180 to 1206, and the first great scholastic commentator of the Vulgate Bible. The divisions have been presented as Langton's application of the organizing principles of Aristotelian logic, genus and species, to divide into units of roughly equal length the continuous text of Jerome's translation that in the original Hebrew was presumed to have been undivided at this level within each book. It has been suggested that Langton developed the schema of chapter division in the University of Paris after 1194 and 1195 to facilitate reference to the text of the Bible in the preparation and editing of his own extensive postilla, or commentary. The so-called Langton divisions came to supplant a variety of varying biblical chapter divisions, of which the earliest examples for the Old Testament originated in late antiquity, with a single schema of chaptering that was essentially uniform from codex to codex, and therefore convenient among university scholars for the purpose of reference in the composition of marginal glosses, commentaries, correctiones, and concordances, as well as in the preparation of liturgical tables. Commentaries on scripture and liturgical instructions that referred to chapter had in the Latin tradition few antecedents before the final decades of the 12th century. The principle of hierarchical division in Latin was not yet firmly established, and several of the chapter divisions current in the 11th and 12th century, notably that used by Alcuin, confounded divisions equivalent to the length of a Hebrew verse or cluster of verses and those we would deem appropriate for a chapter. And you see this here in the same manuscript I showed you last night of the numbering of verses in Lamentations. And you can see how short an Alcuinic chapter was. Paragraph, sometimes a verse, and sometimes the length of something we would recognize as a chapter. And for purposes of a biblical commentator in the 12th century and for cross-references in the margin, this really was better than the Langton chapters. It was very precise. It was very specific. And you can see in these notes here at the side, these additions here and there, these are corrections. And at the same time, just on the eve of and this is a very late example of a Bible in the old system, just when the Langton divisions, or so-called Langton divisions, were about to be incorporated into the Bible, there was a new and unprecedented concern with having them correct and verifying them according to lists, which we will talk about later. In contrast, in Hebrew at this time, and from late antiquity onward, two fixed hierarchical systems of standard textual location exist as part of Hebrew Bibles containing the Masorah, and they were evident in codices from at least the 10th century and probably earlier. Eventually, at least one of these was used by commentators on the Torah for reference and may have been employed so at a very early date. This is an interesting subject, which some of you I may be discussing with in the course of this evening. But the notion of hierarchy was established in Hebrew. In the dawn of the 12th century, it was still not been received in the Latin world, and so you had these chapters of very unequal length, and they were not uniform, and from codex to codex. Until now, the earliest manuscripts of the Bible contained the visions that modern scholars commonly attribute to Langton originated from Paris and have been dated to the first decade of the 13th century, exclusively on the basis of paleographical and art historical judgment. None of them are dated. However, the first textual evidence linking Langton, who died in 1228, to the authorship of these divisions dates on the basis of codicology from about 1230-1235. The evidence exists in two forms, The first is two rubrics in a single Latin Bible of English origin, now Bibliothèque Municipale, Lyon Bibliothèque Municipale Manuscript 414, that identifies chapter divisions in the books of Genesis and Proverbs, with Langton as Archbishop of Canterbury. The second consists of about 1230 lists of chapter in kippets for the entire Bible, one apparently of English origin, preserved in Oxford, forming part of a sermon collection, the other from the Abbey of Saint Victor at Paris, now at the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. Both lists were arranged in what became in the 1230s the standard order of biblical books, but which was neither the order of the Lyon Bible nor that of the earliest Parisian manuscripts with the new divisions. So these things have been commingled in this later judgment that all of this is the work of Langton. In fact, we know about it only after he's dead. Langton is identified as archbishop, but in the Oxford manuscript, the identification occurs only in a table added in the early 14th century. No name is present in the original text, which lacks the first leaf. Maybe it was there, maybe it's not there now. The first categorical statement that Langton actually invented the modern chapter division of the Vulgate was made a century after Langton's death by the English Dominican chronicler Nicholas Trevett, the same Dominican friar we talked about last night who reformatted Jerome's Psalter, Vulgate Psalter, into Masoretic lines, verses, and numbered them. The assertion that Langton did so when he was professor in Paris first occurs in another English chronicle composed later in the 14th century. And it's one thing to identify these things with Langton as a prominent scholar. It's another thing to say that he invented them. That's not to say that statements made about medieval figures made a century after their death are to be discarded, but they are not necessarily true either. And in addition, in his commentaries, Langton didn't use this system. That's another problem for, at least not consistently, and all of those manuscripts are post-date his death as well. In addition to early Parisian manuscripts, English and non-Parisian French monastic manuscripts with the modern chapter division also exist. Until now, the earliest known datable manuscripts with the modern chapter division comes from Canterbury, Langton's titular see from 1207 until his death in 1228. This codex is Paris Bibliothèque Mazarine Manuscript 5, formerly 29, probably copied within a decade after Langton actively assumed his episcopal functions, that is 1213, and surely before the year 1231, the date of an added note. It is the only English or Parisian Bible dating from the first third of the 13th century to be included in any of the modern catalogs of dated and datable manuscripts. Other early, or at least relatively early, English copies of the Vulgate with the modern chaptering include Eton College Manuscript 26, Oxford Oriel 77, and a number of others, some of which have been erroneously attributed to Paris. A full list of early 13th century Bibles of English origin with modern chaptering has yet to be assembled. This omission stems from the fact that the late 19th as well as 20th century scholars assumed that the division identified with Langton had been born in Paris. Consequently, English and non-Parisian French monastic manuscripts with modern chaptering have been regarded as witnesses to the diffusion of a new practice radiating from Paris and not as potential documentation for determining the new system's locus of origin. If we're convinced a priori it began in Paris, why look at earlier manuscripts? And in fact, nobody has in a consistent way. Working with a student at Northwestern, advanced graduate student of Sandra Hyman at Northwestern, Laura Brooke, we took an interest in early 13th century English biblical manuscripts. And we did so as an attempt to broaden the criteria for assigning English origin to 13th century Bibles beyond the usual indicators provided by the presence of a duplex Psalter and by illumination and minor decoration. an effort all the more important because of the standardized character of early 13th century book scripts, which afford only very fragile indications for distinguishing between insular and continental hands. I vividly remember having all of our Parisian Bibles out on a table and showing them to Malcolm Parks about 15 or 20 years ago. And in a, you know, paleographers always like to be authorities. And Malcolm was great because he said, you really can't tell the difference. And such honesty is rare, because there's a mystique in these judgments of the master, and he is the master, but it's true, they are very difficult to tell the difference. I was encouraged in the possible larger impact of this endeavor by the knowledge that Cardinal Robert de Cursson, an Englishman who died in 1218, had been reported to have been the first scholar after Langton to have employed the new chapter numbers. In fact, they're in some of his manuscripts, but it's not clear that they were there before he died. In an earlier study published in Syntagma, I had noted that Thomas Collis, who I mentioned last night, who I identified as either English or Welsh, and who in the second decade of the 13th century was also among the earliest scholars to employ systematically the so-called Langton divisions, much more so than Cursson, he had used a variant form of the new chapter divisions for the commentary on the Song of Songs in 1218. In addition, my initial examination of English biblical manuscripts containing marginal graphic alphabets that we saw an example of, subdivisions lettered A through G, revealed variant chapter divisions and at least two English codices. This one only finds out when one checks a slide or microfilm against a printed Bible, and lo and behold, a chapter of John or a chapter of Leviticus doesn't begin where it's supposed to begin. It begins someplace else because it has the modern chapter division. Scholars have always said, well, they're the modern chapter divisions, and treat it as a lump sum. And basic to this is to treat a Bible as a collection of texts. Each chapter is a book with an incipit and an explicate, and it should be verified. We then embarked on what we believed to have been a pioneering effort to collect comparative data on 13th century Parisian and English Bibles to determine if the variations had been encountered from part of a larger pattern. And to cut it briefly, say it succinctly, yes, we found that there were patterns. It's quite amazing. For certain chapters of Deuteronomy, we have yet to find a manuscript where there's any variant. They're always the same. There are others that have great variety. A few variants have been recorded uniquely in codices prepared at St. Albans before the year 1200. And I'm giving away my story. Why St. Albans? Because that's where we believe the earliest Langton chapters originated, predating Langton, or not his lifespan, but there's no reason to link him to St. Albans. And I give a list of those, which I will not enumerate. There are another group of variants that occur either solely or with far greater frequency in codices of English origin than in the entire Parisian corpus examined to date. Examples of such instances, this is an example of the kind of variants we're talking about, where Leviticus, the sixth chapter of Leviticus, instead of beginning where it does for us at 6:1, it begins in verse 8. And if I could have the next slide. And here you see a manuscript from St. John's College, Cambridge, and you can see that here it is correct. This is an English manuscript. But the English tradition was so strong that was different that it was canceled, expunctuated, with and a new chapter division was put here, which begins here. Because in England, it's a great authority. And when you compare, we've looked at over 120 manuscripts, Bibles, you see these patterns. Here is one verse in Leviticus where everyone is the same, and then there are others. And then you look at the origin of these manuscripts, and you see clusters of English manuscripts which have the same, and where there's an authority. And in this case, you know it's an authority because someone has not accepted the Parisian, standard Parisian thing, division, but has corrected it to an English norm. A fourth group, a very limited set of variants from the schema in use today that occurred with regularity as part of the standardized Bibles copied in Paris from about 1234 on until the 15th century. This is often discussed as if it were the modern chapter divisions, but indeed it is not. It is not only not the modern chapter divisions, it's not the chapter divisions of incunables, because the incunable tradition, we'll talk about that more the day after tomorrow, was based on a variant of this scheme, which was we find in early 13th century additions to manuscripts in eastern France. And that, in fact, is not surprising because printing was spawned in Germany and not in Paris. And so it was a variety of something close to the Parisian, but closer yet to the division that we find, for example, in a Valenciennes manuscript from the first two decades of the 13th century, a 12th century manuscript in which these chapters were added very early. Early on in our research, it became apparent that certain of the English and early Parisian variants often reflected anterior chapter divisions, particularly those present in the Alcuin Bibles, a schema of chapters that occurs, at least for the Pentateuch, fully developed for the first time in the Bible of Abbot Mordromnus, Amiens Bibliothèque Manuscripts 6, 7, 9, 11, and 12. That's the same Bible which also has the first Christian versification that I've found. The Alcuinic schema of chapters thus, in fact, predates Alcuin, closely related to early annotations in the Codex Amiatinus, and it was probably of English or insular origin. If I could have the next slide, please. And what is important in that it helps to see how these were in early French, but especially in early English manuscripts, you had both enumerations present. This is the modern chapter number in the exterior of text. In the interior of the text, you have the Alcuinic number. These are more prevalent in such dual manuscript numbering is more prevalent in England in the English tradition than it is in the Parisian tradition. If we could have the next slide. And you can see this process going on in about 1200, earlier in St. Albans than in Paris. This is about 1200. This is the a New Testament, the Gospel of Mark. Here is the old breaking point, which has been canceled, and the new placed in Arabic numbers. And part of this period of transition was marked by the innovation in graphic means to distinguish the old numbers from the new numbers. One of these devices was to, and we find that in a Paris Bible about where the new numbers were added in about 1220, where D was in front of the Alcuinic numbers, distinctio or divisio, and the absence of the D for the modern numbers. Another was the use of different color inks, which is present here. Black ink sometimes, and we'll see how this evolved in this period of about 1200 to 1220. The advances always being made first in England and then later distributed to the continent. And another was in the choice of whether to use Arabic or Roman numbers. Very frequently at this early period, Arabic numbers were used for the new numbering system and Roman numbers for the old. And this made it, avoided the confusion, which nevertheless transpired between the two of those. And we noticed early on that there was a considerable, when there were these discordances in English manuscripts, that oftentimes they coincided with a concordance with the Alquinic numbers. So the two systems did interfere with each other. And because the weighing of these errors was towards the Alquinic system rather than any of the other systems that were present on the European continent, we undertook an inquiry to see whether, in fact, Alquinic divisions were more common in England in 12th century Bibles than they were in France in 12th century Bibles. And our provisional answer is that they are, but it's an ongoing investigation. If we can have the next slide. And here you see this. This is the manuscript 5 from the Bibliothèque Mazarine. It and Oriol 77, which I showed you yesterday and will show you again today with the alphabet numbers, is in this crucial period of evolution. And you can see here that these are Arabic numbers. Aren't they beautiful? Calligraphic Arabic numbers, and they're in blue and red, alternating colors. And when you, afterwards the lecture, and you can go in the case and you can look at the numbers in the 13th century manuscript, that became the standard way of coloring numbers in the 13th century in Bibles. Before the 13th century, in the 12th century, they were usually all red. In a tradition that goes back to late antiquity and to the Gospels, of the 4th century and 5th century gospel books, the numbers and the division of chapters in red. Red and blue became a way of disambiguating the chapter systems. Here you have the guides for the Alquinic numbers, but they were never put in. Had they been put in, they're put in on other pages, they would have been in red and in the text. That also became a convention. The Alquinic numbers within the text, the modern numbers in the margin, and a way of differentiating between them. If we could have the next slide. And here, this is a simplification of the same pattern, and you have the alternating, bicolored, modern numbers. This is an English manuscript with the Alquinic numbers in the margin. And you can see how a scribe copying could have been confused by this number, which actually pertains to the previous line and starting a line below and making mistakes of this character. And in fact, that often seems to have happened. That explains some of the errors. Others are much broader, like the one I showed you in Leviticus, where there is a truly different conception of where the numbering should begin, but it often begins where there was an Alquinic division. And since the earliest Bibles, which have there are two, and if we go back to the previous one, maybe I'll make it clearer, where you have this bicolored division here, in the first part of this volume, the Arabic numbers are in red, only in red. So someplace in the copying of this book at Canterbury, this convention was adopted. The same is true of Oriel Manuscript 77, the one with the red letters. And when I showed it to you, and you won't remember it, but the numbers were all in red. There was no blue present. So you have two manuscripts, early English manuscripts. We know they're early because they're copied on the rule that they, and for other features about them, and they show this transition to a color-coded way of telling the two systems of numeration apart from each other. Let's go on. Return to the next slide and the next slide. In our quest for finding early manuscripts with Alquinic numbers brought us to Corpus Christi College 48, which I showed you yesterday, important for its Hebrew it's Hebraic presence of graphic Hebrew and its versification through the presence of the names of the Hebrew letters in Lamentations. And what I was struck by this manuscript, in addition to it being the presence of Hebrew, was that it was copied in three columns. And this has struck art historians repeatedly. It's always cited. This is very curious. There are four major manuscripts in the Middle Ages of the Vulgate that are copied in three columns. Two are from the 9th century, and they are the earliest copies of the Theodulfian Bible, which has its own resonances with the Hebraic tradition, and the Psalter of which is reformatted in Masoretic verses and is known to Hebrew scholars and scholars of Hebrew and was influenced by the Hebrew original, but which there is no presence of Hebrew lettering, and two manuscripts from St. Albans. This and Eton College 26, which is a decade or two, 15 to 25 years after this one. And you'll notice the three-column format. Three columns is so rare for medieval Vulgate Bibles, but it is in fact normative for larger format Sephardic Hebrew Bibles, if we have the next slide. And we still find it, and this is the one Hebrew manuscript which was copied in England in the 12th century, and it has three columns. And it's almost the same size as the Corpus 48, which is small for a 12th century Bible. And if we could have the next slide, which I have stolen from David Stern's wonderful catalog of the Hebrew, which he sent me over the course of the summer, and this is what I was trying to arrange with some, to try to get a picture of the scroll open, and he had just done spontaneous to three columns, because this is the rule in the Jewish treatises from late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, that there should be three columns on each member of the scroll, at least three columns, and that the scroll be open to at least three columns. And what one finds is in this manuscript, which has one of the only Latin Vulgate manuscript, that is the Corpus manuscript, to have written Hebrew, is one of two to have three columns on the page. And as we go on, we'll see that there are many other Hebraic resonances in this codex. If we can go on to the next slide. And well, this manuscript in three columns has been dated to the time of Abbot Simon of St. Albans. And Abbot Simon is known to have had contact with the Jewish community of St. Albans and to have been, Matthew Paris, the great chronicler of the abbey of the following century, was rather anti-Semitic in tone, criticized him for excessive borrowing of funds from the Jews, from the Jewish bankers of St. Albans, in order to build a collection of illuminated Bibles. And what I have suggested to you in this lecture, that his debt was more than pecuniary to the Jewish community. In fact, from St. Albans, there's a tradition of contact with Jews and with rabbis. As those of you who are medievalists will know, that there's a whole tradition of dialogues between rabbis and priests in which questions of the interpretation of the Bible are broached, and one of them actually was composed at St. Albans in the 11th century, and in all likelihood, and the earliest copy comes from the Abbey Library. When I was in Cambridge looking at this manuscript, I verified Lamentations, I noticed that it suddenly came to me, it was the modern chapter division. And then I checked other points, and it looked like the modern chapter division. But when I came to this, I wasn't page, this is the table of the capitulum, which precedes the biblical text, and I noticed there was this break here and there was some erasure here. Because when you look at it casually, you would never think that there was any change in the enumeration. But in fact, there is a change. But the numbers are all in red. But here, up until this point, these are the modern numbers. Then the erasure here, and this begins here, the traces of older numbers that have been obliterated and replaced, these numbers, which continue here, which are numbers of which I know not the origin. They're not any of the standard divisions in the medieval Bible. And they are not, they are present, traces of them are present in the biblical text, but they are not present in large portions of the prophets, for example, Isaiah, where the numbers that are in the text, the first numbers placed there, are the modern numbers. So it appeared to me that there had been addition, and I felt that there was more work that had to be done. So I did not cite it explicitly in my syntagma article because I wasn't sure that how to date this alteration that had transpired. An alteration which, in respect to what I've shown you, is very different from the alteration that we see in later English manuscripts and in the earliest Parisian manuscripts with the new numbers. Because this was not cancellation, this was obliteration, an erasure, and a reconfigurating of the manuscript to make it look as if the numbers were absolutely contemporaneous with the confection of the manuscript. If I could have the next slide. This is one of this. There was another manuscript that had to be seen. I'd seen Eton College 26, where one has the obliteration of the earlier portion, but canceling later on in the manuscript. And I wanted to see the Trinity College Dublin, a manuscript of the latter portion of the Old Testament, the New Testament, where there was alteration of nobody had said anything about the numbers as well. And when I checked it, it too had the modern numbers. All of these St. Albans numbers showed reworkings of numbers from one source and done in the Dublin Codex, in the Corpus College Codex, and in the anterior portion of the Eton College 26, in a way that was clearly meant to give the verisimilitude of the initial preparation. If I can show you some more. Next slide, please. Also characteristic of these manuscripts from St. Albans was that these tables of capitula were not like the tables of capitula that were normal in 12th century manuscripts, because they were gathered to the beginning of the codex to form a table of contents. Usually the capitula were before each book. Here they were gathered together for the entire Bible or a major portion thereof. And before this date, before the abbacy of Simon, I know of only one Bible, and that's the Oud Bible, which has been traditionally identified with Winchester, where for the book of Samuel you have such a gathering of capitula. It's unusual. And some art historians have thought that the Oud Bible was actually from St. Albans. However that may be, it's a very unusual practice which did not transpire prior to the abbacy of Simon at St. Albans. And this manuscript is absolutely datable. It's from St. John's College, and it forms the paleographical base for the dating of the numbers, both the old numbers and the new numbers, in both the Corpus Christi College Cambridge manuscript and the Trinity College Dublin manuscript, which are very close in form, and all of which are totally consistent with a date of about 1180, which is the date that art historians have traditionally given to these codices. If I could have the next slide. And you can see here, this is from the Corpus College manuscript. You can see here there has actually been some reworking when you look under a magnifying glass in Cambridge here, but they've been very careful to redraw the tendrils. So they look, you wouldn't look at a page like this and think that anything had been done. In fact, in many pages you can't see that it's been done. If I could have the next slide. And this is in Genesis, and it's the same thing. And what is true is that in both, in the Trinity College, this is the Trinity College, the color of these numbers is very close, if not identical, in the ink with the initials. And where there is a difference between the color of the initials and the old numbers, it's different. So the initials, at least the completion of the initials and the completion of the numbers, were contemporaneous to each other. And the next slide. And here's you can see that there's been some play with a changing of the number of Apocalypse, which there were different enumerations, and this corresponds formally to one of the earlier ones. And this is in the Dublin Codex, but the change number and the initial are very close, and that's consistent throughout the Codex. So we have a reworking of the numbers by obliteration in a way we don't find in the Paris manuscripts, or even later English manuscripts, which argues to the earlier date of these changes, in the 12th century. If I could have the next slide. And with this comes a new sensitivity to the integrity of chapter divisions. In the first slide, you'll remember I showed corrections, and I've mentioned that the evidence for Langton, such as it is in lists of chapter and chippets. And this tradition of incipits in the Latin West begins at the end of the 12th century. In fact, in the Hebrew tradition, lists of the incipits for the Sederim, or the sections of Jewish scripture, existed for centuries before this. And here we have, and this I've consulted with specialists in 9th century manuscripts, no such table exists, and it seems to be the of English composition by Senatus of Worcester. It was referred to explicitly, but without identifying its authorship, by Roger Bacon. And it is, for each gospel, it gives the incipit of the sections, of the Eusebian sections, which formed the concordance in antiquity to the Gospels, which existed for the Gospels, of which the equivalent did not exist for the rest of the New Testament, let alone the Old Testament, until the end of the 12th century. So at the very time then we think that with Langton chapters, the old canons were neglected or vanished, it's quite the contrary. There was a heightened interest in the Eusebian sections and an attempt to standardize them. And in fact, in the manuscripts from St. Albans, another English manuscript, and some French ones as well, one finds corrections that are clearly made from lists, not only of the Alcuinic sections, of the Eusebian sections, and ultimately also of the new divisions that were identified with Stephen Langton. But you have nothing like this. This is, as far as I know, in the Latin tradition, the first table of incipits. If I could have the next slide. And here you can see in the same St. John's College manuscript from St. Albans how this new table has been used, because the numbering was off by one, and it was changed with an added Eusebian section, marked by 2 points, a lateral sophosuch, we're talking about a verse, a division, a distinction, and of a section, and then in the margin over a erasure. And that's part of this phenomenon. And there are numerous corrections in this, and another manuscript, which is at the Bodleian, another New Testament, and their reworkings, and those, I confess, I've not yet done to reconcile them with the table of Senatus, but I strongly suspect that they coincide. We don't have this kind of phenomenon earlier on, although when you do check the occasional uses of the Eusebian sections as used as reference points for liturgical ordines in the 8th and 9th century in Rome, there is a variation. There are variations between the Eusebian sections, which are still produced in the modern Stuttgart Bible and the modern copies of the Vulgate, and they don't all agree. So this confusion offended them, and they wanted to standardize it. There is even more inconsistency in the Alcuinic sections, and they wanted to standardize them as well. And if I could have the next slide. When these new lists came to Paris, this is from the Bible, the great Bible of St. Victor's. Now, St. Albans and St. Victor's had close relations between the monks, and there was exchange of correspondence, etc. There was exchange of books as well, in all likelihood. But what we don't find at in the St. Albans manuscripts, that we do find at St. Victor's, and this I date from the first decade of the 12th century, and maybe one of the earliest sets of the new numbers being put into a Paris 12th century Bible, you have two sets of numbers. And if you look at them, this is 34, I believe. From this angle, it's difficult to read. In itself, one wouldn't notice that. Well, they just put a little askew. But when you look at the results of looking at many, many manuscripts of where chapter 34 of 2 Chronicles begins, you'll find that there's a pattern of variation. And what one has evidence here is that the either one scribe had two lists, or two scribes, or went through a second time with a second list and found they were in disaccord and marked both. And when one looks for it, one can find examples of two numbers being written in the margin of manuscripts which have the old enumeration or no enumeration at all. And in one Paris manuscript, which is from this date of about 1210, probably the earliest Parisian manuscript with the new numbers, one finds actually in the margin the incipit of the chapter division, copied presumably from such a list. So we are in a change and transition from a system where copies were, a Bible was copied from a manuscript formatted into chapters, where it was copied without a format of chapters, and where the chapter numbers were put in with lists subsequent to the copying of the text, which means that there's a different textual division, tradition for the divisions and from the text itself. We could have the next slide. Now, this is another very striking. This was brought to my attention when I gave this paper in an earlier form in Paris at a Langton conference. Some of the Langton people were not too happy to find out that Langton wasn't perhaps the inventor of the chapter division. Patricia Sterneman, who was in the audience, pointed out to me the unique iconographic feature of Corpus 48, and that is that Moses is incorporated in the Genesis initial. It's not unique, but it's very rare. And you have here what is usually said to be God, who is also up above and cut off here, handing the tablets to Moses, who is grappling them. And if we could have the next slide, this is a close-up. But when you look at it closely, it's not so clear that they're tablets, because God has his hand just on the upper one. The lower one is not supported, and Moses is grabbing both. And you could see this, I believe, as a Torah scroll being handed to, and you have a lateral banderole beneath it. And in itself, it's not conclusive. One can never be sure of the exact, exactitude of the replication. But one has, it is true that lateral banderoles are rarer than vertical ones in the Middle Ages. And it is also the way the Torah was written, as a scroll and not as medieval rolls were written horizontally. And up above, God has also a blank scroll laterally displayed. So what I'm suggesting is that the Corpus Bible was meant to be a verisimilitude of of a Hebrew Bible. Presence of Hebrew letters, three columns, and there's some other features that are very Hebraic in this Bible. One is that the order is the order of the Theodophim Bibles, in which the books that are not present in the Hebrew Bible are gathered and placed at the end of the Old Testament, as the Apocrypha is. It's often said, and we'll deal more with this on Thursday evening, but Luther is always credited with segregating the Apocrypha and putting them at the end, which is not true. Theodulfus did the same thing, but it was rarely practiced. It occurs in the 12th century, in the early 12th century, in the Bible of Stephen Harding at Cito. And this Bible, which was where there are many corrections made on the basis of the Hebrew, and those are erased and rewritten, also has added to it, at the end of the 12th century, the new numbering system. This sensitivity to classing those that are not represented in the Hebrew Bible and putting them at the end and out of their historical context is unique for English Bibles in the 12th century. We also have in this Bible the earliest glossary of Hebrew names as a continuous alphabet, as an appendix to the Bible, based on Jerome's work, but continuous and not classed book by book. There are a number of learned articles, Parisian in their orientation, which say that this was the invention of the University of Paris at the time of Langton, and perhaps of Langton himself. But this is a different version, and it has resonances to the other versions and to Jerome, but is an appendix to the entire Bible, and it is, in fact, very much a precursor of the standard Bible that became popular in Paris in the 13th century. Let's have the next slide. This goes back to the Mazarin Bible with the modern chapter divisions. And this portion here shows, you don't see any of the modern numbers here, but you see subdivisions within within the Alcuinic divisions. Because where the Alcuinic divisions were long, they were not ideal for cross-references. And one of the interesting things about the Mazarin Bible is you can trace in its marginal glosses the evolution of concordance notes. Your library has just bought a magnificent Psalter with the Glossa Ordinaria of the early 12th century. In that gloss, there is no marginal cross-reference that I could find, and I've looked in. We have recently acquired a Gospel of Luke with the Glossa Ordinaria, and I looked at the standard editions of incunable edition of the 15th century. There are no cross-references. Cross-references in the margin of Bibles began in the end of the 12th and early 13th century. And they, whether in Paris or in England, they gravitated towards the old numeration because there were more of them and there were more precise locations. But where those precise locations did not suffice or they were too vague, it was too long, we have something very interesting happening here, and it's also present in a couple of other English Bibles, where they were divided. And you have a paragraph 2 in this prior division of the Alcuinic division. And then this is 25, and this is part 2. And in fact, you have cross-references to these numbers to part 2. You also have cross-references to the modern numbers in this Bible with the alphabetic divisions A through G, 1 through 7. And this is probably one of the earliest witnesses to the transition. So in England, we have an intense interest. It's also true at St. Victor, but it's particularly true in England. And the tendency of the English is to be graphically innovative, to evolve a written Latin which is unambiguous and clear and easier for people to track who speak a language which is non-Romance, not related to Latin by derivation. And this presence of these subdivisions, cross-references to these subdivisions, and cross-reference to the alphabetical distinctions is, I believe, significant. If we can have the next slide. And this is the A through G division that I showed you before in Oriel College. This manuscript, 77, this manuscript also has all red numeration here, 8. See, there's no blue. But later on in the codex, there's just a certain number of slides I could bring with me, you have the red and blue bicolored enumeration. So both it and the Masoretic Codex are about at the same time. But here you have the letters for Genesis Oni written out in the margin. And they're A through G. There's seven distinctions. And when I and the person who has studied this development of the concordance and cross-reference in Bibles, more than that, are Richard and Mary Rouse. And they explain everything in great detail of how the English concordance was developed and how it evolved. But basically, none of the writings I've seen about it or of other French scholars, why seven sections? It always bothered me. Why would A through G? And then I've always bothered. But when I compared the new chapter division one day with the Seterim, or the Hebrew divisions, I discovered that for the five books of Moses, there was a remarkable degree of concordance. That the chapter divisions about, for the five books of Moses, it varies between 60 and over 70% of the chapter divisions, points of division, are the same, either in one variation or another, with the Seterim divisions, which was the Palestinian divisions, which were transferred by Sephardic manuscripts and are present in Renaissance manuscripts from Spain in the 15th century, but disappear from the Ashkenazi tradition of Northern Europe, and which are usually copied in three columns. In fact, those Seterim divisions are in the Valdemona Trust manuscript, that is the only 12th century manuscript copied in three columns, in the only Hebrew manuscript from England. So this stimulated my thought that to formulate the thesis that, in fact, what one has here is an attempt to have a Bible that is the verisimilitude of a Hebrew Bible, not only in its mise en page, in the three-column format, which is characteristic of Hebrews, not only in its ordering of the books, not only in its appendix of a Hebrew glossary, but also in its chapter division itself. And very recently, there's been an excellent book from the Hebrew side, which marks the same coincidence with the Seterim. It's there. It's a present thing. And in fact, of course, throughout the Middle Ages, the Jewish segmentation of chapter-like divisions, the Parashat or the Seterim, has had its echo in Christian tradition. But here, there is no anterior manuscripts which have such a high concordance, rate of concordance. And of course, within the Jewish tradition, for each of these Seterim was to be read by seven readers on each Sabbath, which is a very nice explanation of why the chapters were divided into seven parts. That was a liturgical function. But what I'm suggesting is that this liturgical function practiced among the Jews became the basis in England, which was receptive, as you've seen from yesterday's lectures, to Hebraic models, to the development of a reference system, A through G. And in fact, I mean, although in later 14th century Bibles, the Hebrew letters within the Seterim or Parashat are actually written in the margin. There's a similar mise en page. We cannot date it to this time, but it is very likely that the Hebrew manuscripts were emulating, which were copied in Spain, were emulating the relatively rare presence of graphic alphabets, which were usually found in English manuscripts of the 13th century. So there is a graphic analogy within the Hebrew tradition. And which I think gives some clue as to why the seven-partite division was adopted based on letters which had, in the Latin tradition, the value of numbers, and there are many medieval antecedents for that. Now, this asks the question of why these new divisions were introduced in the first place. They didn't facilitate in their earliest emanation a reference system. But they did, I would argue, facilitate another function of the chapter, and that is to facilitate the continuous reading of Scripture. After all, in the Jewish tradition, the Seder were meant, were designed to facilitate the reading of the entire book, five books of Moses. In the Babylonian tradition, within a year. In the Palestinian tradition, within 3.5 years. In the monastic reforms of Flanders in the 10th and 11th century, which have been brilliantly described by Diane Riley in her new book on reform in Flanders, there was a renewed emphasis in Benedictine abbeys to the reading of Scripture over the entire Bible over a year. Now, the placing of the capitula in the front of the Bible is very can be readily explained as a convenience for access to the text and a help to monks who had the daunting task of reading a whole Vulgate Bible. And when you see the Bibles in the case, that's quite a task. Read it aloud over the course of a year. And you can understand, after looking at one of them, you can understand why the breviary was invented in the 13th century. It was too much. But they couldn't do it all during the office of Matins, so they continued it to be read during meal time in the refectory. But the equal division of chapters undoubtedly might have facilitated that. And in fact, when you see the new chapter division present in the Bible added in the late 12th century in the Bible of Stephen Harding, it's not a Bible used for scholarly purposes at all. It's a large format Bible used for liturgical reading, for reading aloud. And in the Jewish tradition, of course, in the synagogue, the codices were not used in the synagogue. It was a much larger scrolls of which were read from, but the codices gave guidance as to what portions were to be read. And it is reasonable to explain the corpus manuscript is initially a guide to reading Scripture. There are no cross references in the corpus Bible, unlike the Mazarin Bible. It is also liturgical in one other sense, in that there is no Psalter in it, which is very characteristic of 12th century Bibles, which are intended for a liturgical function. And in fact, we know from Matthew Paris that Abbot Simon kept his newly confected manuscripts, for which he borrowed so much money to have lavishly decorated. He kept them not in the library of the abbey, but in the church. So the thesis I offer you today is that, in fact, the new chapter division evolved out of a monastic milieu. It was intended to facilitate the continuous reading of Scripture as part of reform, of the Benedictine reform, which was accepted by the Cistercians, and that it was not an invention of Langton. However, Langton can quite properly be attributed as a person who used it extensively in a manner much more profound than the whoever it was who added. It may have been someone close to Langton who added the notes in Mazarin 5, but who he was, after all, Archbishop of Canterbury. But he used it and introduced it in his commentaries, although it is not often present in the manuscript of these commentaries. In trying to organize this material, he may very well have developed it as a new system of reference. And once it was developed, it had a splendid appeal. And within a decade after Thomas Gallus and Robert de Cursson, it had become standard throughout England, throughout France, and entered into Italy, it became a standard reference system. But it is not necessary to accept the judgment of a Dominican friar from the 14th century that it was Langton who invented it.
Any questions?
Comment upon the tricolour system, the green piece of the green was one
most. Well, green is not used in numbers after a certain period. Once you have this period of transition where there's ambiguity and need to disambiguate, a wonderful term that Malcolm Parks used, the number system, green falls out, especially in Paris. And it's just alternating strokes. It is that number system where the first, let's say it's four I's for four. The first I would be red, the second blue, the third red, and the fourth blue. And that carries over throughout the 13th century and into the age of the incunable. It becomes a standard part of how you number a Bible. Whereas before this period, the usual division would be red, which has antecedents going back to actually to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and certainly is very popular among the early Christians. And it is only this tradition of numbering in red is red alone for these chapters, for the first beginning of the text, like we saw in the Psalms of Cassiodorus. This use of red to mark divisions is disrupted by this new, what I call bicolored numbering. And you don't have bicolored numbering in Corpus 48, so it's clearly anterior to this change. It's only red numbering. The same is true for the Dublin manuscript. Eton College 26 shows transition. So does the manuscript from the time of dated manuscript from the time of Abbot Simon, which is the St. John's College. I believe it's G15. If I do not. That is a New Testament, which is firmly datable because there's an inscription of it, of its donation to the abbey. Yes, Nancy, you were going to ask a question.
I was curious about what reception you have received so far with your premise.
It's varied from near riot in certain Parisian circles to rather favorable in others.
Well, it's very intriguing, and I was just wondering.
I gave this at the Rouse Fester thing, and people were very positive.
How much is there a desire to claim the distinction, a national distinction?
Yeah, I think that's true, but of course, I was then criticized in Paris for speaking English, because I wanted to say my theory in a very precise way, and I wasn't so impolite as to insist that Langton might have spoken in English. It's quite possible he spoke in Latin, but no, it's perfectly, it's not inconsistent with, Langton was, all of these people who used it early on were English. There are early Bibles which are English. Why just limited the scope of our consideration to French Bibles, and particularly French Bibles in Paris? Nobody has remarked in 60 years, and there is a thesis by a German from going back from the Hitler time before the war on the Dijon Bible, which notes these numbers, the 12th century numbers, and how close, in passing, that they are very close. They are, in fact, and that's for the New Testament only, but it's for the Old Testament, it's even more apparent. They are the Langton numbers. They are the modern numbers. And they serve no reference function whatsoever. That's a purely liturgical Bible, large format, meant for reading. And when it is copied, I should say, in another Dijon manuscript, which may or may not be from Citeaux, but it was recognized by Paul Martin, the biblical scholar of the end of the 19th century, who did so much work, which was so important, in Paris. And he noted that in the copy of the Dijon Bible, the capitula are grouped as a kind of introductory table. They really are kind of table like you might find in a Summa of Thomas or Albert. They are a guide to the entire work. And that's a change in mentality. So you have these changes, a conception of a table of contents for the whole Bible, concordant notes in the margins of some of these Bibles, a new numbering system, and divisions of equal length, which are very important for liturgical purposes. And indeed, one of the reasons why in the Eton College 26 that the numbers weren't obliterated all the way through is that you have a very complex liturgical table calibrated to the Alcuinic numbers. And some monk there must have noticed that the monk who was eradicating the old numbers was making the liturgical table useless, and that's why it made more sense ultimately to cancel them, expunctuate them, but let them be legible because you could use them for other purposes, for the purposes of the glosses, which in the Eton 26 are to the old enumeration, and to the the purpose of liturgical tables. And it wasn't really until the mid-13th century, and you have tables like the one I showed you yesterday in the Newbery Bible, where you have liturgical tables which are to book, chapter, and letter, A through G. Yes?
Do you have thoughts on what it was about this particular place and time that made St. Albans scribes receptive to adopting this established system of Hebrew numeration?
Well, the first there is this, it was the period of intercourse between, there was an openness to dialogue between Jews and Christians, and Beryl Smalley has described that brilliantly. I think she was a great medievalist of the last century. She was terrific in seeing it. But and what she notes in all the works of Andrew of St. Victor and his peers that she looked at, there is no presence of graphic Hebrew. There's no Hebrew lettering. Andrew speaks about Hebrew punctuation, but there's no effort to replicate it. In England, you have a comfort level with the use of non-Roman alphabets. It comes from Anglo-Saxon. The earliest duplex Psalter I think it's from Canterbury in the 11th century, which has Anglo-Saxon in opposition to the Roman Psalter, and you have letters in that. There is a receptivity to graphic variety and innovation and replicating Hebrew. Of all the manuscripts written on the continent from the time of the Theodolphin Bibles to the 15th century, you can count on the fingers, on the first three fingers of my right hand, those that have any Hebrew in them at all. And one of those, and the only one I know in the 13th century that is Hebrew, that's continental, is Bible 36. I'll talk about that more on Friday. It's a very interesting, at the BN, which is a Cistercian Bible from Beauvais, but probably copied in Paris, where there's a short treatise on transliteration. So the only one to have Hebrew letters has them in the context of a treatise on transliteration, which is to tell scholars how to avoid using them, and that, of course, is the tradition of Jerome. Jerome had in the Vulgate manuscripts, there's no Hebrew. The glossary of Hebrew names has no Hebrew writing in it. Not until the Renaissance, when Estienne and others actually write the Hebrew words in Hebrew as well as in transliteration. The Italian, the Roman tradition, the French tradition is overwhelmingly of transliteration. I give another example, I can't remember, but it's in my Syntagma article of another thing. But it's very, in context, and I wish I could remember her name, it's on the tip of my tongue, the woman who has written a book on Hebrew manuscripts in 13th century, 12th and 13th century England, and they're just numerous ones. When I tried to verify the diglot manuscript I found of Isaiah that I showed you last night, I mean, she describes all of them. She doesn't have the Corpus 48, but is completely consistent with the ones that she had. It just wasn't enough Hebrew to draw her attention. Indeed, what is in the French tradition, which is a remarkable amount of Hebrew, is in the English tradition, it's Banno. And there are many, many examples. There's a diglot Psalter from Leiden. There are many of these books, and it's part of this openness to graphic innovation that of different languages, and ultimately going back to the Irish tradition of writing in a graphically visible and disambiguous way, which is England's great and enormous contribution to the to Latinity. Yes, in the back.
You mentioned today and also yesterday talking about the Hebrew residences, that these are characteristics of the Sephardic tradition of manuscript copy, that, for example, the Corpus manuscript. Why Sephardic, do you think?
Well, these were circulated in England. Actually, the Sederim. I leave that to the Hebrews to describe in detail. I know from what I've been told that you have both. Apparently, it was the Babylonian which came to dominate after the 12th century, and why I'm not sure in Northern European Jewry. But even after these were not used for reading on Saturday, they remain marked in Bibles, especially these Bibles written in three columns. And what they were used for is not so clear. Whether there was a reference system among the Jews, there's some reference to it, but their primary function was liturgical. It is this fructuous interchange between Latin and Hebraic tradition which explains the format of them. And Jews are as much indebted to the Christians as vice versa, because the notion of graphic numbering in the margin is something that's totally un-Jewish and doesn't happen in print until printed in a regular way, at least until the 16th century.
I have a question about the rulings. I noticed on this manuscript and on many of the ones you showed today, there's triple rulings across the top and the bottom of the text columns. And some of them had triple rulings right across the middle of the height of the columns. And I wondered, A, was that characteristic of English manuscripts, and B, why would they put them across the middle of the page?
I'm not sure I can answer for the middle, but for up above it's for the running headings.
Yeah, I know, but why three instead of two?
I don't know. I mean, I wish I could, but the rulings for dating are important is that you see the writing is on the first line, which shows that it's very early in the 13th century.
Yeah.
It's before that transition. I don't know.
Okay.
I'll think about it now. It's one of those things, you know, in these things, there are so many variables in these Bibles that one time, if you try to focus on everything at once, you become numb. So you go through periods where you only look for one thing, and you try to develop a vocabulary to describe it. And sometimes you notice these things very late. I mean, this transition from red to bicolored, I didn't know about it 6 months ago. I didn't know about it when I was speaking at the Rouse festivities in the fall, in October. I just suddenly realized that there was something going on. And then because I have the microfilms, and if there are any students here, I urge you to spend as much on microfilms or CDs as you possibly can, because it'll serve you the rest of your life. Things you never would have looked for when you took your notes, you'll find later on. And so it is with these. Actually, I was put on to this manuscript by an article of Malcolm Parks, was mentioned among the few with the graphic alphabet, but not dating it anyway. So it was after seeing it and going to visit it and trying to explain its curious evolution from red to the more familiar bicolor, that suddenly it all came together when I saw that the same thing happened in the Mazarin manuscript as well. Yes, sir.
In the field of graphic innovation, some elements of architecture appear on some of the manuscripts. What do you think is the purpose, the significance, or the meaning of those architectural elements?
Well, they're traditional for the tables of Eusebius, and I think they're mnemonic. It's part of putting the classical notion of linking architecture to memory. And, you know, we sometimes fall into the error of thinking that this new scholastic culture of the 13th century was something without precedent, and it's not. For the four Gospels, the concordance of Eusebius is an excellent concordance. It's very exact. It allows you to go from one to the other for the same thing. It was remarkably served. Jean Vezin has written about it. Well, what was the limit of the classical world was all the rest of the Bible, the epistles, the apocalypse, and the Old Testament, for which there was no tool, and for which memory alone was the thing. So this was a written memory, a written aid to memory. That's what I think it is. And the same kind of, we saw in for the Incipit table, there's no real reason why it should have that architectural thing, but it's linked to the Eusebian canons. And I spoke to Jean Bazin about this, and he had never seen an Incipit table, so I think this is something new. It's an attempt to standardize, which I think is a departure from the older traditions. Once you have the new chapter divisions, the Eusebian sections don't count. In fact, Roger Bacon talks about it, and it turns out he's quoting sonatas that can be used to correct errors in the text, where the same incident is recalled in the four Gospels, and the word is wrong in one of them. In some manuscripts, you can correct it by seeing the parallel passage in the other. So it's quite consistent with the correction of the Bible text itself. And it's English, clearly English. The only copies of this table are in Corpus 48 that I know of, and in a manuscript in Paris, which is clearly English, and is in Patricia Sterneman's and Francois Avril's catalog of English manuscripts. What I hope to do with this is to complement their work of using art historical criteria with textual criteria to explain this transition. Now, in the New Testament of, which is in the Finch, one of the Finch manuscripts in the Bodleian, which is also from St. Albans, you have for just the Eusebian cross-references for the Gospels, and then for the Epistles, you have these cross-references in the new late 12th century mode of chapter to the new chapter system. It's a perfect example of how one complements the other. Other questions? Yes, in the back.
I'm just wondering if you've seen some sort of connection between the bicolored numbering and the bicolored running heads.
I think there are bicolored running heads in Corpus 48, but they aren't always red and blue. Sometimes they're green and red and blue or different colors. Yeah, I think the idea was there for the headings, but it wasn't used for numbers, because the tradition of using red for numbers was very strong because of its ancient antecedents. If you go back to the earliest gospel books divided into chapters, those chapters divided in red, the numbers are in red. And you can find those in CLA, in Codices Latini Antiquioris of Low, and they're there. It's an old tradition, and there is even red. Norman Gold, my mentor in things Jewish, has steered me to, as I said the last time, red divisions in certain of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which have been interpreted as proto-Sederim sections.
No more questions. Please join me again in thanking Paul.
And just a reminder that Paul will be doing his seminar at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning in the Lee Library, which is behind us. And also, please join us on Thursday night at 5:30 for the third and final lecture.